Chapter 14, America and the Educational Problem. As it lifted from the bosom of the deep by the mighty hand of God, America stood forth to receive the principles of religious and civil freedom born of the Reformation on German soil. To the German government was first offered the opportunity of developing to the full the Reform movement. This full and complete development would have meant religious liberty for all, and a government by the people, Protestantism and Republicanism. These two systems go hand in hand, and are more closely connected than any other principles in existence. The death of one means the death of the other, for the same lifeblood nourishes both. Germany started well. There were to be found princes, liberal in mind and government, who accepted the new religion and stood by the reformers through all their storm-tossed career. God had raised up these men for the time and place as surely as he called Nebuchadnezzar or appointed a work for Cyrus. Protestantism was firmly rooted, and, as we have already seen, during the first 40 years of its existence, so strong was its vitality that men and nations bowed before it. The early reformers, especially Luther and Melanchthon, connected the movement with the fountain of life when they introduced a system of Christian education. And previous chapters make plain the truth that the life of the entire movement in its twofold aspect, Protestantism and Republicanism, depended upon a right educational system. When the mass of German youth sat at the feet of German teachers, and those teachers were true to the principles of Christian education, Roman influence dwindled, and her very life was threatened. It was then that the papacy itself took up the subject of education, and by the work of the Jesuits succeeded in killing the reform in Germany, indeed in all Europe. A day of great intellectual darkness has been shown to be favorable to the success of popery. It will yet be demonstrated that a day of great intellectual light is equally favorable for its success. The Jesuits planted schools of their own in the shadow of Protestant schools. They entered Protestant schools as teachers. They sucked the lifeblood from the young child, and it faded and died. The principles of the Reformation found honest hearts in the Netherlands. The Dutch took up the question of education, but the Jesuits were again on the track, and, as Rank says, they gradually carried their point. The Reformation crossed the Channel to find the hearts of Englishmen longing for greater freedom. Lollardism, started by Wycliffe 200 years earlier, sprang anew into life in the hearts of the Puritans until, in the reign of Henry VIII, more than one half of the English population was Protestant. Finally, the Commonwealth was established. To England was offered the opportunity of showing to the world the perfect fruits of the Reformation in its Protestant religion and a republican government. But alas, the story is repeated. English youth fell into the hands of Jesuits. An English college was founded at Rome, and teachers, ministers, and canvassers returned to their native land with the avowed purpose of their educators, the Jesuits, to overthrow the Reformation. And England fell. Those familiar words from the pen of Luther, which appear in his letter appealing for aid in the establishment of Protestant schools, echo through England also. The word of God and his grace are like a shower that falls and passes away. It was among the Jews, but it passed away, and now they have it no longer. Paul carried it to Greece, but in that country also it has passed away, and the Turk reigns there now. It came to Rome and the Latin Empire, but there also it has passed away, and Rome now has the Pope. O Germans, do not expect to have this word forever. Could this man of God have come forth from his grave a century later and have looked over his loved Germany and over England, he would have added these names to those of the countries where God's word and his grace had been, but had passed away. Must the name of America be added to the above list? May Protestants be aroused before it is too late. Finding that England closed her doors against progress, the Puritans sought greater freedom in the Netherlands. They were disappointed, for they could not there educate their children as Protestantism taught them that they should be educated. As pilgrims, they sought new homes in America, finding a retreat on the bleak shores of New England. It is now our duty to trace the growth and decline of Protestantism in our own land. Its prosperity in every other country has been in proportion to its adherence to the correct principles of education. Its decline has, without exception, been the result of a wrong system of education. How is it in the United States? No student of history, and especially of prophetic history, doubts for a moment that the way was divinely prepared for Protestantism to cross the Atlantic, and it is equally as evident that that same hand was upholding those principles after they reached these shores. God's word spoke often to the hearts of men, leading them to devise plans, pass laws, establish institutions, and in various ways to so work that his truths might here grow to a perfection which they never reached in the old country. On the other hand, those teachings which have frustrated the principles of Protestantism in Europe are seen to be at work in America from the first planting of a colony until the present day. That strength-producing element was Christian education. That counteracting influence was false or papal education. These two form the subject of this chapter. United States history is interwoven with the history of education. Her founders, especially of the New England colonies, traced their origin to an educational center in England, and as early New England history circles about Harvard, so the fathers and supporters of that institution traced their origin in Old England to the counties of East Anglia, where Cambridge University bore sway. Of the first 600 who landed in Massachusetts, 1 in 30, it is said, was a graduate of the English Cambridge. These and their companions were rare men. They had the schooling for a service, the like of whose execution, in completeness and good sense, the world has never equaled. With matchless wisdom they joined liberty and learning in a perpetual and holy alliance, binding the latter to bless every child with instruction, which the former invests with the rights and duties of citizenship. They made education and sovereignty coextensive by making both universal. John Fiske enlarges upon this thought. The greater hospitality of Cambridge University in England toward new ideas is proverbial, and the very names, Lincolnshire, Norfolk, Suffolk, and Essex, Cambridge and Huntingdon, familiar in the geography of New England, are telling a story of Protestant education. Strong as the Puritans seemed in denouncing the Church of Rome and in accepting Protestantism, which at the beginning of the 17th century, more than ever before, meant separation from the established church and the established forms of government, they were not united in thought. There were two classes, Puritans and a class of this class represented by such men as Richard Hooker. Of the Puritans, Fiske says, some would have stopped short with Presbyterianism, while others held that new presbyter was but old priest writ large, and so pressed on to independency. This difference of opinion on religious matters is discernible when representatives of both classes, mingling in the society about Boston, started the educational work of America. Those inclined to remain under the banner of Presbyterianism taunted the others, who were known as Brownists or Separatists, and who followed William Brewster to America with anarchy merely because they believed in carrying out fully the principles for which all were ready to fight. Thus, from the first, has our educational work fallen into the hands of two classes of men, a class willing to compromise in order to keep peace, and a bold, daring class who advocated stepping out on truth regardless of what might follow. There was a mighty educational problem before the church. The Episcopalians had failed to take up that work in England. It was from their midst that William Brewster, a Cambridge graduate, John Robinson, who also was graduated from Cambridge in 1600, and William Bradford, afterward governor of Plymouth for 30 years, withdrew to form the nucleus of the Congregational Church, which had its origin at Scrooby, England, and ended in Plymouth. What Episcopalianism had overlooked in the matter of education in England, it now became the duty and privilege of the new church to begin on the virgin soil of America. The reader is familiar with the fact that the Puritans, leaving England because of civil and religious oppression, the result of a union of church and state, came to America for freedom, and contrary to what one would expect, especially at a casual glance, they here developed a theocracy. The aim of Winthrop and his friends in coming to Massachusetts was the construction of a theocratic state which should be to Christians all that the theocracy of Moses and Joshua and Samuel had been to the Jews. In such a scheme, there was no room for religious liberty. The state they were to found was to consist of a united body of believers. Citizenship itself was to be coextensive with church membership. It is equally well known, however, that this theocratic form was soon broken, and while the United States is beginning to find herself again approaching this mode of government, it is a remarkable fact, and one well worthy of our closest consideration, that the ancient theocracy of New England was broken by the power of the educational system there introduced. When this is read from the pages that follow, let the reader answer the question whether or not the repudiation of Protestant principles and the principles of republicanism by the United States in the 19th century is equally due to the present system. Bear in mind the question as we proceed. The educational history of the United States may conveniently be studied in 3 sections. 1. Colonial, 2. Revolutionary, 3. 19th century. Number 1. The Colonial Period. Since Harvard College, the American Cambridge, accomplished, as Boone says, a much-needed work with manifold wholesome reactions upon society and government, so that it has been affirmed with show of truth that the founding of Harvard College hastened the revolution 50 years, our study of the schools of the colonial period will center around this institution. It can be stated with safety that the history of Harvard, its leading men, and its varying attitude toward different colonial problems throws light on the development of the question of education at the time when the foundations of our national government were laid. When Boston was but 6 years old, plans were laid for America's first college. Among the early educational leaders, says Boone, were such men as the Reverend Thomas Shepard, John Cotton, and John Wilson, Jr., all clergymen and all college bred, Stoughton, Dudley, the deputy governor, and above all, Winthrop, the governor, the guide and good genius of the colony. Such were the men of the infant colony. Here were learning and character, world wisdom and refinements of heart, breadth and wholeness of culture, such as could alone justify the boldness of their attempt. The institution was started in poverty, £400 being voted by the people. The high motive which prompted the enterprise was an unbounded zeal for an education that to them seemed not so much desirable as necessary, that the light of learning might not go out, nor the study of God's Word perish. The object of the school, as held by the founders, is well described by a Boston citizen who writes thus in 1643 to some of his friends. "After we had builded our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for worship, and settled the civil government, one of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and to perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in the dust. And as we were thinking and consulting how to effect this great work, it pleased God to stir up the heart of one Mr. Howard, a godly gentleman and a lover of learning then living among us, to give the one half of his estate toward the erecting of a college and all his library. In the contemplation of a college by those noble men, the uppermost thought was how to gain an educated ministry. This object was lost sight of. It must be remembered," writes Boone, "that for 60 years the institution was little more than a training school for ministers, managed as a theological seminary, having religion of a more or less well-defined type as its basis and chief object. Yet, as Professor Emerson has put it, it is one of the most remarkable things in the history of Harvard that in all the constitutions of the college there is nothing illiberal or sectarian, nothing to check the freest pursuit of truth in theological opinions and in everything else. And this, too, while the founders of the college were severely and strictly orthodox, often exclusive in their own opinions, and while their object was unquestionably to provide for the thorough education of ministers of the gospel in like views with themselves. The very foundation idea of the college," says Boone in another paragraph, "was the theological want. The presidents and members of the corporation were generally the prominent scholars, the theologians, and the political leaders of the community and time. The college easily came to be the arena upon which, or the interest about which, were fought those terrible logomachies of dogma and doctrine. These required, as they had, the best learning, the shrewdest insight, the most politic minds of the day." This perhaps explains that former statement, that the education of ministers by Harvard had more than anything else to do with the overthrow of the theocracy established about Boston. It is interesting also to note the spirit of democracy which this institution fostered. In speaking of the raising of the funds for erecting the building, Boone says, "The colony caught his," that is Mr. Harvard's, "spirit, and all did something, even the indigent. One subscribed a number of sheep, another 9 shillings worth of cloth, one a 10-shilling pewter flagon, others a fruit dish, a sugar spoon, a silver-tipped jug, etc. No rank, no class of men is unrepresented. The school was of the people. It was nursed by democracy, and it in turn nursed democracy. Surely the Spirit of God was pleading with men so to arrange their leading educational institution that the principles of the Reformation might be perpetuated. The course of study for this minister's school, as described by Emerson, was remarkably free from sectarianism and liberal in thought. The Bible was systematically studied for the entire 3 years, Ezra, Daniel, and the New Testament being specified. A year was given to catechetical divinity. Students were required to attend worship twice daily, when the scriptures were read in Hebrew or Greek, and they were required to translate the selection. History received some attention, but the sciences were practically unknown, and all profane literature was excluded. Through all this is discernible the attempt to educate for the cause of Christ. With this beginning, what might have been accomplished had the plan, with truth unadulterated, been followed? the work done in later days by the schools under the direction of the state is but an indication of the broad field which lay ahead of Harvard and similar institutions had the church remained in her province as the educator of her own children. From the very foundation of Harvard may be seen indications that there was alongside of these principles of Christian education somewhat of medieval teaching, which, unless discovered and banished, would act as leaven, permeating the whole loaf. For instance, when the college was less than 20 years old, we find this requirement for admission announced. When any scholar is able to read Tully or any like classical Latin author extempore, and make and speak true Latin in verse and prose, and define perfectly the paradigms of nouns and verbs in the Greek tongue, then may he be admitted to the college. Nor shall any claim admission before such qualifications. This, of course, was patterning after the European universities, and theirs was a papal system. This was the Harvard of colonial times. As we enter the revolutionary period, we may look for changes as the result of both the correct and the incorrect principles harbored. Is Harvard, with all her wonderful facilities, training as many for gospel service today as she did of old? Yale, the second congregational school, followed closely the plans and object of Harvard. William and Mary, the second college in the United States, was founded under different circumstances. It was born in the midst of wealth and was befriended by cavaliers and courtiers. The roots, says Boone, were deep in the great English ecclesiastical system, and yet the avowed object was that the college, when established, should be a seminary for the breeding of good ministers. Notwithstanding good intentions, it mixed scholastic teachings, for it stood for the Oxford order of humanities, the abstract as the foundation of the concrete, everything for discipline, the ancient languages before the modern. Jefferson was a graduate of this school, and later it will be seen how this man, whose mind comprehended so clearly the principles of religious liberty, strove to break away from this mixture in education and advocated a decidedly secular education in schools which were supported by the state, thereby avoiding in such institutions the mixture of secular and religious training. So far, we see the Episcopal school, William and Mary, deeply rooted in the English ecclesiastical system, and unable to receive the Reformation principles of education pure and simple. The two congregational schools, Harvard and Yale, approached more nearly the Protestant ideal, but being unable to break wholly the bond of scholasticism, they made much of preparatory work in the classics. Some of the educational problems with which our colonial fathers had to wrestle were parental responsibility, the general viciousness of indolence, the educative office of labor, the state's relation to individual need, compulsory employment and schooling, the state ownership of child life, and above all, and including all, the relation the church sustained to the schools, how far secular education could be offered in Christian schools, and how far the church could ask aid of the state in the conduct of church schools. They were weighty questions upon which hung and still hangs the destiny of a nation. No sharp dividing line can be drawn between the colonial and the revolutionary periods. The work begun in the colonial period prepared men to act a noble part in the revolutionary period. The truth of the educational system would bear fruit, but the error which we have already noticed was in great danger of gaining strength enough to choke the pure principles. Mere accusations amount to but little. Let it suffice to follow the history of educational progress through the next century. Results speak for themselves. Number 2. The Revolutionary Period. In addition to the instruction given by pious Puritan parents to the flock in their own homes, a limited number of common or church schools was established in the colonial period. The position of academies, as they develop in the revolutionary period, is significant. We find that alongside each of the first colleges, frequently antedating them, sometimes forming part of the organization, was a grammar school. Such schools, attached to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, William and Mary's, and others, prepared for the universities and supplemented the work of the elementary or common schools. Herein lay a vital point. They had home schools, elementary schools, and colleges. It was impossible for these elementary schools to fit students for university life when such schools required for entrance that the student should read Tully or any like classical Latin author extempore, and make and speak true Latin in verse and prose, and decline perfectly the paradigms of nouns and verbs in the Greek tongue, as has already been quoted from an early Harvard announcement. The universities founded by the church were then forming a course of study for these grammar schools, or academies, as they were soon called. And since the demand was for a classical preparatory school, naturally their courses were fitted to the time-sanctioned curriculum of the college. They taught much Latin and Greek, an extended course in mathematics, and were strong generally on the side of the humanities. This was a modeling after Rugby, Eton, and other noted English schools, or the classical drill schools of Germany, which, as we have before seen, were schools bearing decided marks of Jesuit teaching. Should a young man care to pursue his studies beyond the elementary school, his only opportunity to do so was in one of the academies where the classics formed the sum and substance of the instruction. The tendency to revert to the established forms of European education, or the papal system, is plainly visible. The first colleges had been planted to give a Christian training, and doubtless had a start which might have resulted in the greatest strength to the church and to the nation in a secondary way. But the introduction of these grammar schools or academies, with a course of study in the classics made necessary by the universities, threw the majority of the young people into a classical instead of a practical line of instruction. Looking at it from one standpoint, no wiser move could have been made to turn the tide of educational reform again toward papal education. Can we here trace the footprints of the Jesuits, whose policy since the days of Loyola had been to overthrow Protestantism by a false system of education? The effect of the mixture of the pure and the impure methods, traceable in indistinct lines at the very beginning, now assumed more definite proportions. The growth of academies was remarkably rapid, and when attention is called to such men as Franklin, the Adamses, John Hancock, and the generation of 76, who received most of their education in these schools, it may seem like sheer presumption to condemn their work. The results, however, as seen in later years, warrant the charge that at that time was taken a long step from the principles of the Reformation, which meant to this country a weakening both in Protestantism and Republicanism. These academies were denominational, it is true. Still, they offered this prescribed course of instruction. Almost immediately appear signs of the result of this union of Christian education with scholasticism. For instance, we read that Brown University, though founded as a Baptist institution, was nevertheless one of the first schools of the period to emphasize the growing sentiment for a thoroughly undenominational collegiate training. Why should a denominational college give an undenominational course of instruction? And why, above all denominations, should the Baptists do so, to whom such a flood of light had come, and who always, with pride, pointed back to Roger Williams and the state of Rhode Island as the ancestors and embodiment of all that is Protestant and Republican? But this is not the only indication of this decline from early principles. About 1793, Harvard assumed the name of university. Boone says, signs of Catholicity also appear, in that students were no longer required to attend the divinity lectures except they were preparing for the ministry. Literary societies, voluntary associations for social and general culture, were multiplied. The first Greek fraternity, the Phi Beta Kappa, the parent of both secret and open college fraternity organizations of America, was formed at William and Mary in 1776. This is another indication of the stealthy introduction of principles opposed to democracy and which tend to break existing prejudice against the secret organizations of the papacy. Again, Yale also, though nominally on a congregational foundation, received aid from the state and gave place in her corporation to state representatives. Educational apostasy was beginning. Religious decline must follow. Boone gives another paragraph, which, in a few words, tells a story of much significance, more perhaps than the author realized, for he was merely chronicling the history of education, not searching for the philosophy thereof. He says, "The college, once an appendage to the church, was seen, in view of imminent state dangers, to have an equal value to the Commonwealth. This, of course, is true, because the Commonwealth depended for support, for the very existence, upon the educational ideas propagated in its schools." But the writer continues, "First encouraged because it provided an educated ministry, there was coming to be recognized an opinion, despite the deficiencies in culture, that education is something more, that it has a value in itself, that schools might well be maintained apart from the church as an organization, and in no way lessen their usefulness." Here was the challenge. God has placed in the hands of His church the right and privilege to educate the young. In doing this, He has done more, for in educating the youth, the church stands at God's right hand to guide the nation into paths of rectitude. Not by joining hands can this be done, for church and state must, in order each to be free, be forever separate. Still, the pillar upon which the nation must stand, the only one upon which it can stand, is a true system of education, and this is a divine gift to the church, which was born of the Reformation. To the Lutheran Church, the message of education was preached by Luther. The Episcopal Church received this word and grace of God, as Luther expresses it, but it passed from them, and they returned to scholasticism. Oxford, Cambridge, Eton, Rugby, all English schools testify to this. The message passed on to the Congregational Church, and Harvard, Yale, and others started on the right road, but through the glories of the world lost sight of their original object. Harvard, founded to educate ministers, sent forth in the year 1896, out of a class of 400 graduates, only 6 ministers. The Presbyterian Church had its opportunity, and likewise the Baptist and the Methodist. Rapidly, education, the scepter with which America was to be ruled, was slipping from the churches. Of the 4 colleges established during the war, 2 were non-sectarian, as were 3/4 of the 16 colleges founded in the 20 years after 1776. A momentous time was reached. Not only were the colonies to organize a government which would astonish the world, but the people of these colonies were on the verge of an educational precipice, and mighty interests were hanging in the balance. We have seen that from the classical academies came forth the minds which, for a generation or two, bore sway while the nation passed its critical period. There were the Adamses and Jefferson, Franklin, Webster, DeWitt Clinton, Horace Mann, Joseph Henry, Everett and Story, Guilford of Ohio, Grime of South Carolina, Frelinghuysen of New Jersey, Wayland in Rhode Island, and Shaw in Virginia, besides Kent, Clay, Marshall, and Randolph, who were, many of them, not only solving political problems, but exerting an influence in the school systems planned for their several states. Many of these were classical academy men, and we can but see that the education received in these schools must affect the systems they would father in their several states. Had the colleges remained true to their trust with Christian education, the academies would have been preparatory schools for Christian colleges, and men sent forth from their walls would have been firmly grounded in the principles of Christian education, going forth into every state of the Union to found Christian schools which would in their turn make earnest and valiant youth true to Protestantism and true to Republicanism. When the church fails to educate, men turn to the state. These men differed in their views about the Constitution and wrangled over the dangers of centralization. The best men were fearful of the inroads of slavery and the dangers to commerce, says Boone, but all agreed that intelligence was necessary to citizenship. Washington said, "In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is necessary that public opinion should be enlightened." And Jefferson urged that the diffusion of light and education are the resources most to be relied on for ameliorating the condition, promoting the virtue, and advancing the happiness of man. There is a demand for the highest and most practical kind of education. Statesmen see that statesmen citizens are needed. The denominational colleges ceased to educate Christians, and citizens must be educated elsewhere. In 1805, the Public School Society of New York City was formed. The claims of public primary education were urged in Boston in 1818, and New York provided for the county supervision of schools. Early in the 19th century, were either introduced or else discussed the first high schools, manual training schools, and mechanics institutes, teachers' associations, teachers' publications, professional schools, and free public libraries. We have entered the third period.